Accession number 27185, reel 60.
Major Barras, reel 60. You were saying you didn't take much notice of the country as you were arriving because you were talking to the commanding officer.
Yeah. But of course, after a bit, driving backwards and forwards and going around the place, you soon got to get the general sort of geography there. It was very hilly and mountainous further in, and a lot of it was sort of bare altogether with no trees, because the Japanese had chopped down all the trees during the occupation. There weren't any trees there at all. Well, when I say none, there must have been probably some here and there, but basically the place was bare. And then the flat lowlands was all paddy fields, with the local Chinese all bent double, either planting or pulling or doing something in the field, up to their knees in water. I think that's about sort of sums up the general sort of view one had in place. I remember looking at an old passport, and it was the 16th of April that I arrived there, so that I do know.
You mentioned that you were in temporary accommodation at Pan Ling. What
Yes.
sort of accommodation was that?
Well, they were all Nissen huts. The main, although there was a house there, so presumably the place was selected because of the house, which was used as Bataan headquarters and one or two other things. And then the Nissen huts were put up round them. But of course, this was the temporary accommodation everywhere was because of Mao Zedong. Originally, the main garrison in Hong Kong was in Kowloon or on Hong Kong Island. The Navy had a big base, HMS Tamar, it was called, on Hong Kong. But the there was also barracks for a battalion, I think, on Hong Kong. But then everybody else lived in Kowloon. There was nothing, as far as I could gather, there was nothing out on the new territories at all. So when Mao Zedong swept down through China and nudged along the border of Hong Kong, he was so unpredictable that nobody knew what he was going to do next, and fired up with triumph, he could, I suppose, have suddenly walked into Hong Kong. So anyway, before he got there, I think, it was decided to increase the garrison of Hong Kong, purely for political reasons. We couldn't have stopped in the horde, the Chinese hordes. And all these temporary accommodation barracks and whatnot were built out on the out in the new territories. There was a brigade based round Fan Ling. I think the Northamptons, I did make a note of it somewhere, Northamptons, I know the Royal Own, King's Own Royal Regiment, and the South Staffords, and ourselves. There were four battalions, but there were three, one was based back, I think the King's Royal Regiment was back in Kowloon, or on Hong Kong Island in that barracks, one of them was, and the others were three battalions were up. Around the Fan Ling area with the brigade. I think the brigade headquarters is background there too as well. So, and then there were the 7th Hussars tank regiment. They were based in new territories further behind us, I think, but I wouldn't be sure about that. And then the married quarters, there was where we lived, it was Sekong. Fan Ling was about 25 miles from Kowloon, inside the new territories.
Well, how far from the border would that be?
Oh, in a few miles, 2 or 3 miles. Well, maybe a bit more. I can't remember actually. It was close enough up for battalions there to occupy positions and to do patrols along the border. So we were probably not more than about a couple of miles or so behind the border.
How was the border actually marked?
There was masses of barbed wire all the way along. Yeah. The minefields everywhere. Yeah. and patrolling was done. Patrols were up and down. And one of the first things I had to do when I got there was to be... I was happily given the company. I can't remember which one it was now. I was to go and have a look at my company positions and get a general lay of the land. And I remember standing on... There was a small building there of some sort, although I don't think... It wasn't used. It was just a one-story building I stood on there. And you could look straight down into China. And we could see there was a small village there. And you could see the Chinese sentries wandering up and down. We weren't particularly impressed with their turnout and dress, but that was there.
Did you have any idea of what strength they were?
Oh, not at all. Well, we probably did, but I mean, it didn't matter very much. I mean, they could call on thousands and millions if they wanted to. I mean, we were there really as a deterrent. And to make it look worthwhile, I suppose they had to call in more troops. Hopefully, I think they hoped that if the Chinese did attack, that there was enough up front to hold them for a little bit, whilst a lot of people could be evacuated behind who they didn't want to fall into Chinese hands. Families, security people, give them time to have bonfires with all their security documents and whatnot, get the governor out, and that sort of thing. And the rest of us would have been put in the bag, I think, without any doubt at all.
What sort of positions had the company got?
Well, they were the normal defensive positions, I mean, slip trenches.
Were these two men?
Two men slip trenches, yes. I mean, that was the norm in those days. Mm. But they were sighted back behind the minefields and the... And then there was, of course, the artillery had DFs worked out so that we could call on them if need be. There was a field regiment there, 25-pounders.
Were these good positions, do you think, from a tactical point of view?
Well, from a tactical point of view, considering the ground that we had, they were effective. We were on a sort of slightly higher ground there. I think the new territories were specifically mapped out in the original agreement with the Chinese 100 years ago, that at least it could, whatever we took could be defended. So,
did the Chinese have any defensive positions on their side?
I didn't see any. As I said, you look straight down into this village. I don't think they were bothered. I don't think they ever thought we were going to invade China, so I don't.
Well, they used to say that they were defending China against wicked imperialism.
Oh, that's right. Yes. But we were a very small bit of wickedness. So I don't think
we do admit to the wickedness.
Oh yes, very wicked. Yes. If I had my way, yes, we'd have millions of Brits.
Did you have any contact at all with the Chinese?
No,
the
not any, only visible. Yes. You could see them, but no, not a bit.
You said you weren't very impressed by their appearance.
Well, not their turnout wasn't up to our standard. Neither was the way they sloped around, really. They didn't seem interested in doing a thorough job, so to speak. I think they fairly knew in the back of their minds that nothing was going to happen. Although, you never know, actually, but a sort of simple-minded peasant there who had been told that we were wicked and anything could happen, he might be thinking that we were going to come across any time and slit his throat. So perhaps he was a bit worried, I don't know. But the married quarters were split. Sekong was where the temporary married quarters were built at the time that the rest of the temporary accommodation was put up. And these were, they weren't Nissen huts, gratefully. They were sort of, I called them greyhound traps myself. They were bungalow type, built with sort of temporary accommodation. They had two rooms. I suppose it depended. You had a big family, you could probably have a bigger one. We had two bedrooms, a sort of common sitting room and dining room, kitchen, bathroom, with an L-San lavatory. There was a sort of a small concrete patio outside where I could sit and drink cold beer in the evening when I got back. And then there was a bit of garden, which was what I called the living dead, because you couldn't grow. I tried moving boulders around and tried to grow things there, like maize, and nothing ever happened. The only living thing there were snakes and scorpions, which did appear now and again. And then we were on a hill overlooking the airfield at Sakong, which was down in the valley, flat land in front of us, which was manned by the RAF. And they had one or two squadrons of Venoms there, the jets. And down there also was a brigade of Gurkhas of two battalions. I can't remember who they were. I can remember we had to go to some of their festivities and watch goats' heads being knocked off and that sort of thing.
It would not be Dushera, wouldn't it?
What?
Dushera is that feast.
Oh, was it? I couldn't remember. Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
It's the main annual
feast. Yeah, that's right. We used to try and show our appreciation. Because they used to try and take the goat's side because it just
didn't work.
Didn't work, no. That was it, I think. And then there was a lot of the families still lived in Kowloon because the married quarters there. So they had to go to work. If their regiment, or of course it could be the Royal Engineers, it could be Remy, it could be Signals, it could be anybody, out of Fanling or anywhere else, they had to get the train. And there was one train which ran, I think, at a particular time in the morning, which they all had to pile into and go the 25 miles every day commuting in this train out to Fanling. The rest of us living at Sakong used transport. So I think there were about six from my regiment who were actually in Sakong. And we had our own transport. And that used to leave at a certain time. And they used to go around this car used to go around, I think it was sort of a large, like a minibus thing, used to go around the quarters collecting people. Yeah. And you had to be ready. When it came outside, there was no question of having a second bit of toast or anything at breakfast. You just had to get up and pile in. Otherwise, the hooter would go and shouts from inside, come on, come on, you know. So eventually, we all got in and drove off down to work. It was commuting. I never... previously, when I'd been with the regiment, I've always lived with it. And when I was a bachelor, I lived in quarters, and the depot I lived in the married quarters in there. I'd never lived like this before. I felt half away, so to speak. You know,
semi-detached,
yes, because in the evening, the car was there ready to take us all home, whether you liked it or not, at whatever time was fixed. But if you had something that you really had to finish, which was quite serious, then you could always get another car to come and wait for you and take you home. But normally you had to be ready to come home at a certain fixed hour. So we commuted.
It doesn't sound a very military way of life.
No, it wasn't really. It was, as you say, it was semi-detached, and one didn't feel the same sort of belonging as I did with, say, the Bedfords or the Essex, which I've been, second Essex I've been before. Because we were now one Essex, don't forget, because they...
Was one Essex different in any way from...
Well, it was entirely different, yeah, because I didn't know anybody there. Mm. Paul Clemente Smith, and Mike Holm, oddly enough, was there.
Yes.
we're the only two I'd known before. Mm. I knew nobody else, officers or none of the other ranks at all. I was lucky insofar as I had an excellent company sergeant major who was ex-guards, a very cultured, quietly spoken chap, but very firm, had everybody's attention and respect. A very good sergeant major. He was so good that he became RSM after the last one left. He was one of the, I think he was one of the best warrant officers that I've come across. We have one or two. I mean, RSM Sutton, who was with us initially, was excellent, imposing figure. I think I mentioned his pictures in the National Arm Museum. On
yes.
And he became chief warder at the Tower afterwards. But this guy was absolutely excellent. He didn't shout for the sake of shouting. He was understanding. If a chap had a problem, he sorted it out, and he knew when people had a problem, or when they were idle, if they were idle, and he told them so. Everything was idle in those days. It was an expression which was used that you have idle buttons, which meant they weren't clean. You're idle on parade, which meant you weren't doing your stuff properly. Or you were idle if you went absent, you know, you were idle on, not on parade. It was an expression that was used frequently for everything which was wrong was idle. So I'd joined. As I felt that I thought I was going home, but I wasn't really. Mm. The second in command was a chap called Sam Pepys. He pronounced it as Peeps, actually. I mean, when I say actually, it's spelt that way, but they pronounced it Peeps, Pepys. He was a nice chap. He and his wife seemed to be older than they really were. I don't know what it was. They had no children. They were getting on a bit. His father had been in the regiment. He had a quiet sense of humour, but we never really got to know them. Getting to know families there was very difficult because they were scattered everywhere.
Yes.
The ones which, funny enough, the ones which we got to know best were the ones which were on the troop ship with Anne. There was Wing Commander Tim. Oh, God, what was his name? It doesn't matter. Anyway, he was Wing Commander and was on the mixed headquarters in Hong Kong with his family. And then there was Nigel. I made a note of their name somewhere. What? I always forget his name. He did very well later, actually, I think. Can't remember. Anyway, the two of them lived in Kowloon, married quarters there, and we used to go and see them mostly. Locally, there was a chap called Miseroy, whose name I've forgotten, who had an American wife, and they had a small family and lived just opposite to where we were. He was a captain. We got to know them quite well. I found out that he, through my magazine, eventually became a full colonel in doing a job in the States, and recently died. But that was about that. And then we had a Gurkha family nearby. We got to know, but we didn't get to know our own families very much.
Do you think it was made it more difficult for you to get to know your soldiers, the fact that you were living away from them?
I suppose it probably could have done, although, I mean, you're with them all, as a company commander, I was with them all parade hours, exercises, any training, all the training we did, individual training, you had them up on company office, or coming up on compassionate grounds, or coming up for interviews, barrack room inspections and all that sort of thing went on. No, I think one got to know one's blokes pretty well. A lot of them are National Service, of course, and I had great admiration for them. We treated them like regular soldiers. We didn't. There was no quarter.
Were they up to strength? Where did you have enough?
We were up to strength at that time, but we gradually began to sort of moved down a bit as time went by, because when we got home we were going to be merged, so that was taken. I don't know whether we knew, certainly when I first went there I don't think it was known, but it became known later, and therefore they ceased to send us drafts after a bit, and of course people were going home, And by the time we went home, we were probably about half strength, I would think, probably over half strength. We still had a job to do, so they couldn't run us down to the extent that we couldn't do our job. But they kept us up to strength for that. But
I've got to ask if there was any change in the political atmosphere while you were there to justify the reduction in strength.
I don't think so.
Because if, I mean, if the purpose of you being there was to make a sort of political gesture of resolution to the Chinese, then running...
Oh, I see what you mean, from the Chinese point of view. I really can't remember, and quite honest, I can't remember whether we ever got relieved.
Do you remember if there was any idea that there might be an internal security threat?
Oh yes, we had to be prepared to turn out for that, in aid to the civil power.
Yes,
and a lot of training was done on that. Mm. You see, Hong Kong was overpopulated then because of all the refugees coming in. And although a lot of tower buildings have been built to try and cope with the influx, they still came in. And although the borders were being, there were certain parts of the border where they could get across, I don't know how they did it, round the sides, I think, chiefly, were patrolled by Gurkhas mostly. And they came in small boats round the side, of course, and could land anywhere.
Yes.
And there was a certain amount of resentment from the residents about all these people coming in, either taking accommodation or being a nuisance or probably committing crimes in order to keep themselves fed. But there was never any, as far as I know, there was never any animosity towards the British there. Because they were pretty, the residents were pretty well off, they were well governed. The local police were very efficient. They had British officers, and most of the constables and NCOs were Chinese. Some of their senior chaps were Chinese. The detectives were CID, were a mixture of British and Chinese. And they worked very well. And I'm sure they were quite capable of putting down any sort of small fire.
Did you have, as company commander, did you have liaison with the police?
Yes, I'm sure we did. But I can remember the instructions we got. Of course, an officer's career can be ruined completely by a misjudgment when confronting civilians. It's not the sort of thing we wanted to do because the army confronting civilians was both repugnant and something we didn't like doing. But if the police failed or felt they were going to fail, then we would get called out. And of course, we had to do a lot of training. At times, when there was a thought that there might be trouble, then we had an inline picket which had to stand by at so many hours' notice, a platoon mostly, or could be a company if it was going to be bad, but I don't remember any such situation. We had to have with us medical orderlies, a bugler, somebody who could write up a diary of everything that happened there. And if you could take a photographer, so much the better. And although we were called out, the civilian government was supreme. We were under their power. It wasn't martial law, obviously. And when called out, we were under a magistrate. And the C&D officer had to keep in close contact with the magistrate. So we had local lectures by magistrates who were supposed to read the riot act to the crowd, call out three times that they were going to, that if they didn't disperse they have to take the consequences. Before he spoke, the bugler had to blow and call their attention. Then if we could, we had a banner with in the vernacular which said, "Please go home." well, not quite like that, but bugger off, and so in whatever language it was. And then if the thing started getting out of the hand and the police couldn't hold them and the magistrate had done his bit, or as far as he could go, he would then hand over to the officer, who would then have to have strict orders according to the Manual of Military Law and Queen's Regulations. And he had to then designate the soldier who was to fire a single shot. Machine guns were absolutely out. He would then designate the target at whom he was to shoot. You're never allowed to shoot over the top or use blanks, because that merely encouraged people, because they thought, well, they're not going to, nothing's going to happen, so we can carry on. And then as soon as the we were told, as soon as the object had been achieved, and that would be in the hands of the magistrate, he would decide. He'd say, right, that's it, and take the management back from the officer. And then hopefully that time the crowd would be dispersing, and on no conditions would we ever, once the crowd started to disperse, there was no shooting ever to take place. And then the wounded were to be helped. And all this time the diary was being written to make absolutely sure that everything that was happened took place, so that there'd be no repercussions afterwards about somebody making false claims about brutality and that sort of thing. Then the officer had to make his report.
Did you ever get involved in it?
No, we never had to, thank God. Yeah. But it's in stark difference to a Brigadier General Dyer in 1919, who broke every rule in the book. He shot at a crowd which was trapped in an unarmed crowd in a tank. He used I don't know how many rounds. He killed over 300 people, wounded 1,000, and then left. Didn't look after the wounded, and then pushed off. The thing about that is he never had any British troops with him, which people don't seem to realise these days. They always say the British troops were there. It was a motley gang of 50 Gurkhas and Indian troops who had been hastily put together and taken down there by the brigadier. Anyway, that is what we were taught. But happily, we never had to use it. But it just goes to show how very carefully, how you just can't go out there and do what you want.
Did you ever have any idea that you might have to face not civil disorder, but perhaps guerrilla warfare operations?
No, that never occurred. I don't think there was any threat of guerrillas, either from the Chinese or from the Chinese, both sides of the border, our own Chinese and their Chinese. I don't think there was any threat of guerrilla.
What were your patrols supposed to be doing then? You said you had a lot of patrols going out.
Well, not a lot, but I mean the borders were being patrolled all the time. A lot of it was to prevent people seeking asylum from the other side, refugees. And a lot of it was really to make sure there was no sign of anybody trying to get through or attack. I mean, they could have sent patrols through, or tried to. We would have known, I'm sure we would have got plenty of early warning had there been an attack coming, because there were plenty of Chinese moving backwards and forwards over the borders, and I'm quite sure we had our own Chinese people the other side.
Well, also, you'd got the wire and the mines, hadn't you?
We had the wire and the mines, yes, but I mean, if there had been any concentration of troops or they'd been assembling the other side, I think we'd have got wind of it pretty early on. So I don't think there'd been any doubt that we would have been caught.
You mentioned going on exercises. What were the exercise facilities like?
Well, we had the normal company battalion and some brigade exercises.